Okay, this is David Klein meeting with Rick Tuttle on April 15th, 2010. And Mr. Tuttle, if you could introduce yourself, tell us when and where you were born.
I was born in New Haven, Connecticut, in January of 1940.
Mm-hmm. Which would make you how old now?
I'm 70, and at this point, 3 months and about 10 days.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about your family and your upbringing, and if you see sort of connections to where you ended up later in life?
Looking back at it, mm-hmm. I see some. I don't think I saw at the time, but I, my mother's side of the family is from Arkansas most immediately. She was raised there, and so was her mother and father. But the family came to the Tidewater for the Mayflower, and then went down to up country South Carolina, and then up to Georgia. And my grandmother's father was a little boy, a sort of medical orderly in the Battle of Atlanta.
Hmm.
So I would got a pretty good dose of the white Southern point of view in terms of Civil War, Reconstruction, and so on and so forth, and race relations. As a little kid, I was 5 or 6, lived in Arkansas during the Second War. Dad went to the Marine Corps at age 36. And so Mom moved the family back down to Arkansas. So I lived there for a couple of years. I got a pretty good look at what segregation meant. I didn't like it as a little boy. Then on my father's side, my grandmother, and both grandmothers were important in my life. My mother was ill, so both ladies at different times took care of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then later lived in our home. So I was very, and they in turn were the child or grandchildren, respectively, of people who went through the Civil War and Reconstruction. And you may have seen the movie Glory
mm-hmm.
and the Massachusetts 54th. That day on those assault waves was the Great Connecticut Sixth. And my grandmother's grandfather, in a well-known family story, Monroe Gillette, took a bullet on that day on those assault waves, and he later died on the Petersburg front. The two ladies, when they would get together around the Sunday table for dinner after church, simply could not agree on what to call it. Be it the Civil War, the War Between the States, the War of Northern Aggression, the War of Southern Rebellion. I got interested in that. I lived in the North and chose the Northern side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of the family background. We were pretty sensitive to history. And in fact, you'll probably find a lot of people involved in the Civil Rights Movement wound up in the Academy, wound up being historians.
Mm-hmm. So making that segue, can you tell me a bit about involvement in the movement and how you, when you first became aware of the movement and attraction to it?
Well, there is a kind of prehistory
mm-hmm.
In at least in some parts of the country, up in the Northeast. I went to a little college in Middletown, Connecticut, at Wesleyan University. At that time, we were about 837 young men when I enrolled, and we stayed about that size, and almost everyone, one way or another, lived in a fraternity. I was part of the three fraternities on the campus, which broke from its national because of a white Christian-only clauses, one of which was public and the other of which was a hidden clause, and we basically fired our national. Now, it didn't take a lot of courage to fight for civil rights in the middle of an Ivy League college in the middle of the Connecticut River Valley. But we learned the vocabulary of civil rights. And we also learned about taking on fairly established tradition and to some degree social power at a time when everyone in liberal circles was concerned about the silent generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the conformity, there was a lot of concern in the McCarthy and post-McCarthy 1950s. And so we, au contraire, we took that on. And in fact, a companion to this weekend, together is next weekend. A lot of us in that particular fraternity for the second time in 50 years are going to be getting together. We're bound together by that shared commitment to, as we saw it, to human rights and to civil rights.
Mm-hmm. And were there public expressions of that that you were involved in Middletown?
Well, our break from the National was a major campus issue. Mm-hmm. Put the university administration on the spot, put them in a tough spot in terms of alumni. There were two other houses that also broke, but we were very much out there in that battle. And then came the sit-ins. In the north, the sit-ins in the south, and there were marches at Woolworths and so on in the in Middletown. I cannot remember if I actually walked the line at a Woolworths store in either Plattsburgh, New York, my hometown, or in Middletown, Connecticut. I just don't remember. I remember thinking about it, but without any documentation or without any artifact or pictures of myself, I just can't remember. I did imaginatively, but I have some training as a historian. I don't say what I don't remember. I don't guess.
Right.
In any event, then what happened is in 1961. To me, the precipitating action were the Freedom Rides, and there is a very lovely, well-known moment in the history of the Freedom Rides. A small part of the history of the Freedom Rides, and a rather large part of the history of Wesleyan at the time, which was the first ride went to Anniston and was burned in probably every high school textbook in the country has pictures of the bus burning in Anniston. There was the Deep South at that point had never been broken. That is to say, segregation had never been broken. And I was aware of that. Arthur and Lucy, who had attended as a college student, had been driven out of the University of Alabama. And James Meredith, had yet to try Ole Miss. Little Rock had been tough, but it wasn't quite the Deep South, as my mother kept saying to me. Now, when the Freedom Ride took place, there's a well-known phone call from William Sloan Coffin at Yale to John McGuire, who was a teacher of divinity and a Yale Divinity School classmate of or acquaintance of Sloan Coffin, and also once had roomed with Dr. King and had expressed his views on these matters, a call of conscience. There had to be another bus to go down and to carry on and go through the South. And and also there was a pincer movement. The pincer movement actually figured into my thinking. There were also buses organized in 61, late spring and summer, coming from the West Coast and come into pincer movement. And Jackson being kind of the center of attention, Jackson, Mississippi. And Dr. McGuire was a very well-respected teacher at the college, marched into Dean Swift's office, a dour, tough, sort of every college has to have someone who's the chief operating officer, and the disciplinary and high standards, and said, I know this could cost me my job, I'm in my first year here, he said, but said John McGuire, who's retired president now of the Claremont College of California. But he said, and this story spread like wildfire, by the way, so I knew it contemporarily. He said, but I must answer this call of conscience, even though I have final exams coming up and final classes. Remember, it's in May of 61, and Wesleyan finished up in late May, early June. And Swift looked down and had a sort of dour expression, picked up the phone, called his wife, and said, some young fool is going to go on this Freedom Ride. I better go with him. And they went together. So when they went, Wesleyan went. So I missed that ride, and so did my roommate. And we wanted to go too. We had felt the same pull. We would not have met Wesleyan going, but we by then had understood the issues. And what we understood was the genius of the Freedom Ride, namely, this was clear-cut interstate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
No way you can claim local ordinances trump that. It's interstate. We got that. You just had to be willing to test it. So 2 years later.
Now, how were you following this news, or how were you getting news of what was going on? Was this spreading through student sources or newspapers?
We're hearing contemporarily, but also we we were pretty steeped in the New York Times and the Herald Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
We read it regularly. And we also, I was part of this group of fellas who in the previous 3 or 4 years, I was now in my junior year as it turned out, and I'd taken a little time off college. I was originally in the class of 61 and wound up in the class of 62. What a time to take off, 1960, reading Camus. I mean, everything I could read in English, not bad.
Right.
And also, and I think there's probably some correspondence to C. Wright Mills just as he was dying. I had written him. I had taken some time off. I had busted my hand playing basketball.
Hmm.
And dare I say it, I think one reason I keep playing basketball at age 70 is because I was always the ninth man on a team to use eighth and the eighth man on a team to use seven. So I'm still trying to cross them.
So did you play at Wesleyan?
I was the ninth man on the team that used eight, the eighth man on the team that used seven. And I played at Plattsburgh High School.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to get into all that. Yeah. I was a pretty good high school player at a small high school. But the, go on and on the subject. But we saw the, a very important point. Our fraternity, Wesleyan had very few black students, but the black students there were, with about one or two exceptions. I'm talking about a very small number, less than two handfuls,
mm-hmm.
little less, maybe two handfuls. Except for a couple, the rest were in our fraternity. And I was a scholarship boy, as were some of these lads, and I washed a lot of dishes and waited table. This is not Les Miserables. I mean, it was mm-hmm. a job. Most of us have done this to get through school. And so did these fellows. So we were very, very well acquainted. Furthermore, without being unduly inappropriately modest about it, I was not terribly socially adept, so I had a lot of time on weekends. I was the favorite of all the professors. Spouses on campus because I was always available for Saturday night babysitting. I was very popular with the junior faculty who lived near the campus. So I didn't date much, eager though I was to. I couldn't find any willing subjects of my attention. These fellas, who were all state Iowa in sports, double 800s, president of our class, things like that, couldn't get dates
mm-hmm.
at Smith, Mount Holyoke, other places. There was a story where we stormed out because they wouldn't dance. The girls wouldn't dance with the guy we were on. We all stormed out. You know, we had a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Stormed out. So they were around too.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to go up. They were going to date the same, they wanted to date the same type of young ladies we dated. Last seen in Chariots of Fire. Abraham's, I'm an Englishman.
Right.
And these were Wesleyan men, these were Brown men, these were Yale men. They date Mount Holyoke and Smith and Vassar, and they couldn't get dates. Or they didn't feel, they'd been turned down and turned down and turned down. And, or at least been turned down a few times or couldn't do it. So they were around, so we spent a lot of time together. So I saw the civil rights movement through, to some part through that prism.
Mm-hmm.
And also in part through the prism of my dad and mom and grandfolks and grandparents in Connecticut in the South, I mean in the North,
mm-hmm.
Having come from the Southern experience. In any event, what happened is I then went to graduate school. There were some roads not taken, didn't go here or there or the other place to grad school, but I wound up coming out to UCLA to do graduate work in 1962, and John Poppe wrote an article. It's an important article, which appeared in either Collier's or Look, probably Collier's, a magazine that used to be around, on the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and voter registration. It was about Sam Block and Charles McLaren, Wooly Peacock may have been in the article about them registered voters in Mississippi. And the basic data is remarkable, only a potential voting base. Much, much larger than the 25,000 Negroes who were registered to vote at the time, and all
mm-hmm.
not just the literacy test, but the terror, and so on and so forth. And I saw the article, got into conversations with people about, this is outrageous, we ought to be able to do something about this. Voter registration, for God's sake. And also I had seen here and there in the paper, Tom Hayden, Bob Zellner, others getting pushed around, you know, knocked down the famous picture of Tom. And at least one of the fellows was, maybe two brothers, I think, were at Trinity College, and that kind of clicked. Wesleyan and Trinity are near each other, and rivals in sports and so on and so forth, and had some identification there. So the fire hoses, Birmingham, and I saw that. It was May. By then I had been out a year and in college, and I had lined up a teaching assistantship in history. I took my doctorate in history. I lined up a teaching assistantship for the next fall, and I had a house advisor, they called it, sort of a junior fellow in a residence hall at UCLA. So I was double covered, and here I am with Birmingham. I'm single. I have no debt. Obviously, based on what I said earlier, no children or any prospects thereof, and I turned to someone whose advice I admired, whom I admired, advice I took seriously. I said, fellow, I was working as a kind of a nanny and taking care of the children. He was a very busy guy, a terrific fellow. And I turned to Norm Reskin and I said, he'd been a World War II hero. I mean, he'd bailed out over Germany, fought his way out, came back, you know, one of these war heroes of that generation, tremendous guy. And he and his wife, just lovely to me, and so on. And down at seats, I said, what would you do if you were my age? He said, well, I'd do it. And you know, he talked about it for a little bit. And I thought about it. I said, boy, if I'm ever going to get involved in this, I don't have debt, I don't have, you know, and so on and so forth. And so the next day, I bumped into Steve McNichols, whose back had been broken in a freedom ride coming from, well, remember the pincer movement? I had run into him and had some early conversations with him about what his experience was, because he had something, he and a whole group from the West Coast were mirror images of what would happen to the East Coast Freedom Rides with John McGuire and all that. And I got in a conversation, acquainted with him, and I bumped into him. After talking to Norm Reskin, I went to sleep, got up the next morning, went into campus, and sure enough, I bump into Steve McNichols. I'll leave it to others to conclude whether it's a Jungian collective unconscious or gods at work or whatever. I'll leave that for others more learned than I to figure out. But I bump into him, and I said, I'm interested in going down to help register voters with SNCC. And I alluded to the article. He said, well, by the way, Sam Block is going to be in town tonight with Charles McLaurin. They were up raising funds in the Bay Area. Steve would be the natural person to know that. He later became head of the Civil Rights Division of the National Student Association. Played some role in breaking open the CIA penetration, or to control of NSA. But in any event, the International Division. And the he said, they're going to be in town tonight. And I said to myself, well, Baptist term came to mind. It's time to come to Jesus. I thought I'm either going to do this or not. I said, well, let's, I thought, yeah, I want to do it. So, and so.
Now you're currently enrolled in school.
I'm a graduate student.
Right.
Into my first year of grad school.
Right.
My academic work is in hand.
This is, you know, what time of the year?
It's in, it's as Birmingham is rolling along. We date it from that. I don't have documentation on this particularly, but I would say it's certainly after May 15th or 16th, and as I recall, before June 1st.
Okay.
But I was, my work was in hand. By then I'm a grad student, second semester, and so my work was in. I had turned out, I had papers, I turned it. So that every I worked to it. So they arranged for me to meet Sam Block and Charles McLaurin, and I remember I called my folks to, not to ask their permission. I'm 23 at the time. I'm not 19 or something, and I'm the aides of men who command men in combat. I mean, you know, and I called up and I said, I said, Mom, Dad, Mom took the call, I'm going to Mississippi to register voters. My mother said, honey, I'm from Arkansas, not Mississippi. Please don't go to Mississippi. And of course, the old joke about Arkansas, you know, what Arkansas always say, Arkansas is a very poor state. Thank God for Mississippi. But that's not what she was talking about. It was tough down there. And in parts of Arkansas, too. So, and other. So I went, but I went, and we drove down, and that starts some of the story in the. I keep on talking, but that starts begins the story in the narrative about I was in Mississippi, and then I went on to some interesting things happened.
Mm-hmm. Let me before we get there. Let me ask you. You know, in that conversation with your mom, did she understand why you felt you had to go?
Well, she understood that, I'm not sure. She knew her son was now, had grown up, and what's that term we use? My late wife and our parents have a 28-year-old, so my daughter ever pulls a stunt like that on me. Of course, I said to my daughter, be careful, and she went off to college. She went to college in Northern California. I live in Los Angeles. And she said, I will, and about, when she was about 23, as a matter of fact, the young lady went skydiving. So I don't know. I mean, Jesus. So, but they were apprehensive about their son and his safety. Mm-hmm. You got afraid I'd get myself hurt, badly hurt. I was pretty clear in my own mind what part of my assignment was. I'm going down in 63. This is before the 64 business. And I was pretty sure that part of my job was to draw some fire. I understood that. I knew, my dad by then was the, my dad had been the dean at the college, basically the number two or three person at SUNY Plattsburgh, State University of North Carolina, Plattsburgh. But by then he was my dad was education program director for NASA.
Hmm.
And NASA was NASA in those days. Hmm. And I knew what would happen if they came for me. I mean, a good idea of it draw attention that would not be drawn from people who were local, or particularly if they're black, and so on and so forth. And I'm coming from a somewhat different experience than some of the other young people were white, did other types of experiences, and their families did in this country. But in any event, I grasped that, I understood it, enough sense of history, and enough sense of the likelihood. My dad, you asked about my mother, my dad was also apprehensive. There's a very important formative story, which gets into this, which is that when I was a little boy coming back up from Arkansas, I was on a train coming up. I was just turning six. And the train got coming out of Memphis. The trains were jammed. The war was over. They even had deserters in handcuffs. They had POWs. They were moving. The joke was the kids on the West Coast, Oregon, California, Washington, fought the war in Europe. And the young men on the East Coast fought the war in Asia, and everything was all screwed up. It was sort of like that. And at all the great switching areas were Memphis and Cincinnati. Anyway, the rolling stock was old. Hadn't built trains in the 30s or the 40s, to speak of. The train broke down outside of Memphis, and so we knew we were being delayed. We're trying to get in. There were no rooms. And here we were, a family of three, my mother pregnant, my brother had a burn on his arm and deaf, and we didn't know what was wrong. My dad in uniform. And my mother, and we got off the train in Cincinnati, a delayed train, and we could see the New York train over there starting to leave, and it was moving, the big Cincinnati train station. Dad turned to it's very relevant to all this, but Dad turned to the conductor and said, can you help us? You know, this family's about four tracks away.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'm sorry, sir, I can't do anything. Dad turned to the sleeping car porter, stepped over to him, and said, can you help me? And handed him something. Some car some sort, just handed him something. Train stopped. Never seen anything like it. Bam, 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 hand signals. I stopped it. The New York train stopped and we, you know, lumbered. I said, Dad, what'd you show him? And my dad showed him his NAACP card. And at that moment, I learned something about organization. He pulled a Randolph suit. I didn't know about it, Randolph.
Right.
So in any event, Dad's reaction, and he's a grand, after all, I'm the great-grandson, he's the grandson of, his mother, and he lived in his mother's home, he was the eldest, and a beloved child. She was 34 when he came along, a very beloved, welcome addition to her life, and it was her granddaddy who's the Monroe Gillette.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned and all the mm-hmm. rest of it. Right. So in any event, the...
So do you know the story of how he came to join the NAACP?
Well, my dad was probably the greatest track coach in the history of New England, at least up until I left New England in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
10 out of 11 state championships. And my father also was on the Yale team that won the national title, and which was the Penn Relays in those days. In 1928, so Dad competed the way Otis Chandler, the great publisher of the LA Times, mm-hmm. you know, he's a tremendous. Chandler said he learned a lot about men who were black that he wouldn't have otherwise met with Stanford background through track and field.
Mm-hmm.
People like Malpitt, Field, Harrison, Dunner, these were great trackmen of the time. Dad was constantly in the mix, both competitively and so on, and also was teaching. And his mm-hmm. teaching assignments were at Eaton School in New Haven, which is a major school. He was very much involved in the community and in sports and, mm-hmm. and in teaching and in education and so on and so forth. And our first hero was, the two heroes, Jackie Robinson, was a big deal. Remember, I'm born in 40, so I'm old enough to know what's going on at age 7. But Levi Jackson was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Yale football coach, Yale football captain. First Ivy League, sorry, well, maybe not Ivy League, but first Yale football captain was African American. We all were raised rooting for Levi Jackson.
Hmm.
On the stoop in New Haven, living in here, a bunch of white folks all rooting for Jackie Robinson. That's pretty good mm-hmm. from my point of view. So anyway, off I went.
Mm-hmm. And did you know where you were heading?
Greenwood, Mississippi, which is where John Poppe's article was grounded. And by then, Sam Block had graduated from, he's deceased now, he died in Los Angeles, he got, in some ways, fairly close in one respect, and he moved out there. But we drove across the country to 708 Avenue Inn in Greenwood, Mississippi, and we Bob Moses, who ran the office, was away. Mr. Moses was somewhere other than, I think he was up north, northeast, variety of, one thing that's interesting about a conference like this, you pick up pieces of where people were just from, you know, you put the pieces together from parts of their own narrative, or people speaking of them. And,
So that was the office address, or was that?
That was, SNCC was doing a lot of, that's the office address in Greenwood, Mississippi, mm-hmm. of the Council of Federated Organizations, COFO.
Right.
Which, as you probably know, is the combined SNCC and NAACP. They can all have their differences in New York or Washington, but in the Delta, you're better, even in Atlanta, but you're better pool resources. And there was a core and SNCC presence. And so the idea was I'd be doing, in my own mind, voter registration, I was quite prepared to do direct action citizens mm-hmm. as long as they wanted to. Basically, as long as it was ethical, and I had every reason to think it would be, I was prepared to do what I was asked to do or told to do. And I wasn't there to give orders or give instruction, I was there to basically do what I was asked. And I did. And the person, and I literally was in, after I was there a few days, and we had a close call in Canton, Mississippi. We were down at a voter registration rally. And I remember we was a rally. We were over on the third base side, and one of the, I think it was probably Willie Peacock, walked up to me and said, "Time to go." That's all he said. And he said, "Just walk slowly." So we just walked slowly, and he said, "Don't look back." Well, as he turned towards the cars, we walked over to the cars to get in, I could see what they were doing, because over on the first, on the right field side, you could see the cars with the boys, you know, the Confederate flags flying, carloads coming, everyone just walking away, the crowd dispersing, and we drove along. White driving with black is, in that context, is very dangerous. They had me sort of slouched down in the car, remember that? We drove, getting dark, and we just moved out of there and went on. We were talking about religion earlier. Mm-hmm. One of those other ventures, we went to a church in near Canton, Mississippi, down that way. Where the incident happened was a baseball field in Canton. Went down, and I still remember, Sam Block was not there, but Block's great organizational gift is he was a very well-known, in the very early 60s, late 50s, as a singer. He had a group, and he'd go around Mississippi. He was a personality already. He'd also gone to school up north for a little bit, and come back down, I think, up in Vermont. And dreadfully sad he's not available to be interviewed, but Willie Peacock, of course, you probably have interviewed, could interview, he's a legend, at least in my mind, and I think a lot of others. But anyway, hearing the singing in the church and the, and I'll frame it this way, the Exodus story. And, you know, go down Moses, way down in Egypt land, tell O Pharaoh, let my people go, and so on. And they just, it's powerful stuff, very deeply informed, and people were prepared to go out and get their heads cracked, but informed by this type of, these metaphors and by this song and so on and so forth. And I was there for a few days. And then word reached us one morning. I was literally sleeping in the same bed with Lawrence Guy. We were all bunched into kind of Freedom House, kind of house behind a house, a little hard to find. And he got up that morning. We literally sort of nestled in with each other. And he said, "Oh, I've got to go out. I just got word." He said, "Mrs. Hamer's been arrested with, I think he said, four young ladies. And Mel Ponder," he named, you know, June Johnson, a couple of others, "got to go bail them out." So he drove over there, got up on a Sunday morning and drove over to bail them out. Or as I remember, it was a Sunday morning. I'm pretty sure it was Sunday morning. He drove over to bail them out. And didn't come back for a while. And he was running the office at the time, Mr. Bob Moses up north. And, so, and the story was they took him in front of the Baptist church in broad daylight, took baseball bats and just beat the hell out of him. He smashed his head, expanded his head, doubled the size of his head, of his skull, and threw him into, and took him into custody. And so now you had, and word was reaching us, that Mrs. Hamer and the young ladies were being beaten up and brutalized. He had been brutalized. And remember, this is Mississippi before the March on Washington. This is Mississippi before this and before that. You're closer to the Mississippi of Emmett Till than you are to the Mississippi post Cheney Schroeder.
Right. And what town is this for the arrest?
Winona, Winona, Mississippi. So Willie Peacock is now known as Wazir Peacock. He said, "Well," so we worked together, and it was, we both have, at the time, immediately afterwards, and in retrospect, we happened to see each other a few weeks ago after a long hiatus, years. Agreed, it was remarkable how two people kind of click. Where I basically did what he told me to do. I did my best to do it. And one thing he had me do is he remembered this, and I did not remember it. But now I'm beginning to remember. One thing I did was, I remember I have a white voice. I called a clerk at the jail, as he recalls it. He was reminding me of this the other day, and I did do something like this. to basically inquire about people and to get a location of some sort where they were. I don't remember the details as well as he does. I made a whole series of calls, and he made calls. We were both working. We were about it. Everyone else was 18, 19 years old, at least the ones that were around, or 17 or 14 or 15. So, but we could, so one of the first things that he asked me to do is to call Edgar Evers and to ask for his, Mr. Evers' help. He's head of the NAACP in Mississippi. And so I called him, and he said, well, I said, Mr. Evers, and I explained to him, I said, Willie Peacock from the COFO office that asked me to call. And he said, Mr. Tuttle, I will want to I am going to help, but I let me call you back, he said. I'm just out the door to a mass meeting. I will call you as soon as I get back. Or I'm just out the door to a meeting. I'm not sure he said mass, but to a meeting. I'll call you when I get back. And a little later, word. So about the time I was expecting the call, somebody called and said, this is later in the evening, that Edgar Evers had been shot. The odds are pretty good that as he fumbled for his keys to go into his own home, thinking, oh, I'm going to call that fellow back in Greenwood because Mrs. Hamer and the others are in jail. So so all hell breaks loose in Jackson. That's the famous moment when John Doerr walks down the street saying, I'm John Doerr from the Department of Justice. But this was unstructured, tremendous feelings. Edgar Evers was a major figure in the South and a major figure in Mississippi. He was the voice of decency in the Emmett Till business, which was 8 years earlier, or a little less than 8 years earlier, and so on. He was dead. And
do you recall how you found out about it?
Well, someone phoned. When the phone rang, I remember it was late, and even in an office, it's a busy office, a phone ringing, I say, oh, he's calling me. It turned out it was someone else. I'm not saying it would, certainly wasn't someone from the Evers household calling me, but someone called us, and it got to me, and so someone else answered the phone to say, Edgar Evers has been killed, or Edgar Evers has been shot. And we rather quickly learned that he had been killed. So, meanwhile, we are, all we had in those days was the New York Times with Claude Sitton and Carl Fleming at Newsweek. There was nothing else. The AP was in the hands of the segregationists. UPI was not in the scene. There was no LA Times Bureau in the South. There was Greenville Delta Democrat Times, but that was up in Greenville as Hunting Carter's paper. There was a good paper in Lexington, but what we could do was call Friends of SNCC groups. A lady in Chicago was terrific and called around the country. That's one thing Peacock had me doing, to get phone calls going into the jail, because to stop the brutality on the prisoners and keep from getting killed. Our job now, as Peacock said to me recently, was to keep them alive, which we did. And we kept calling, and meanwhile, but we couldn't, had trouble locating, or we thought we were having trouble locating Giad, and we weren't sure of where the ladies were. So, and that's very scary because, of course, if they start getting moved around, this is what I remember contemporarily being told, start moving people around, then everyone's responsible and no one's responsible in front of an all-white jury or even a reasonably decent prosecuting officer is prepared to go part of the way to justice, maybe a step of the way. There's just no relief because no one knows anything and everyone has some culpability, etc. So, and also they could have been let out in the middle of the night, which is hyper dangerous in those situations and so on. So we've had civil rights workers shot and wounded, badly wounded in broad daylight. So, and, as you know, De La Beckwith threw down his rifle, didn't even bother with the prints. So, we now know it was Myron De La Beckwith from Greenwood's matter. So, Peacock, Willie says, we've got to locate him. Rick, call the governor. You can get through. And so he basically scripted me. And so I called the governor, called Governor Barnett, and I explained, as I called in, who I was. I didn't, you know, graduate student from UCLA, and so on and so forth, but I'm here in the office. And he came on the line. And I said, Governor, I was doing what Peacock told me to do. And I explained again to him who I was. And I said, we can't find them. And we're asking for your help to find them. And I want to tell you what'll happen if we don't find them. If your office, if you don't have the appropriate person call us and tell us where they are by tonight. And I gave a time, and I can't remember now what time, but by 9 o'clock tonight or by 6, it was some reasonable time. I assure you of something. We know you have your hands filled in Jackson. All hell's broken loose down there. You've got every fishing game warden, every highway patrol officer, everyone you can lay your hands on down there to keep order. I promise you we'll have large demonstrations here, large nonviolent demonstrations here in the Delta, which Peacock had told me to say. And he said, son, are you threatening me? I said, Governor, I'm new here. I'm reporting to you what I've been told. And he said, well, let me let me look into this. And within a reasonably short period of time, the Highway Patrol called, Mississippi Highway Patrol called, which last time I looked reports to the governor of Mississippi and said where they were and so on. So then to get them out. Now, the person before we had said it had been brutalized, had his head bashed open. And in one of the braver acts I run into in my life, Andrew Young came out. He had been in Birmingham anyway, as I remember. So I now know he drove past Wynoma, as I recall, to the Greenwood office, turned around, went back. And I remember, and with the bail money, as I recall, I remember thinking to myself the 23rd Psalm. And in the valley of the shadow of death, will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff. And he went and brought them out. It's one of the two or three braver acts I've seen. And he went, he tells a story about all that too, but I wasn't there. Well, he came out, and Mrs. Hamer and so on, and there's a double aspect to this. They had miscalculated, because through the agency of some very remarkable people, about a year later, at the 1964 Democratic National Convention, it was Mrs. Hamer's testimony before Congresswoman of Oregon Edith Green's Credentials Committee at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, where she described in detail what had happened to her. And she was the leader of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And she riveted the attention of the country, and she went blow by blow through what happened to Wynonna. She had been kept alive, and she broke it wide open. And that convention, as you can recall, was emotionally the convention of President Kennedy and Senator Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Northern Western delegations were civil rights delegations. The whole business of the celebration for John F. Kennedy would take place after Mr. Johnson was nominated and so on and so forth. The whole Mississippi challenge, that whole fight. The other part of it, of much less importance to the country, but of some importance to me, word reached the civil rights people. I wouldn't have known that. De La Beckwith had said he was going to kill. They believed the assassin of Mr. Evers was from Greenwood. And word reached the civil rights folks in COFO, SNCC, that he was now going to come after the white boy. So they decided, I'm the white boy. So they decided, and he had shown he's a good shot. So they put me in a car and put me under a blanket and took me to Memphis and flew me to the SNCC office in Atlanta.
So this is when?
It's by now. It's after Mrs. Hamer's out, and it's right after Megar Evers. So it's after the 13th, 14th, 15th of June. It's a little later, and I go into Atlanta, and I'm there. That's when I meet That's where I'm in the SNCC office, and after someday some direct action, we SNCC was stretching the covenant that had been worked out between Dr. I'm a little out of my depth on this exact history, but as I recall it, contemporarily, as I experienced it, it's a contemporary matter. There had been an agreement reached, a tacit agreement reached, that the major civil rights organizations would not do direct action, particularly in Atlanta. Atlanta was doing pretty well, in spite of Georgia statewide ordinances, in terms of doing fairly well, moderately well, in terms of moderate is probably the word, in terms of some desegregation, but not to press too hard against the envelope in the home base of offices in Atlanta, where several of the civil rights groups were.
Right.
SNCC decided to test that. Off I go into a lunch counter sit-ins, and I remember there was a reporter from the Berkshire Eagle named John Kiffner, who later wound up as a reporter for 30 or 40 years with the New York Times. And Kiffner's standing behind me when this, a bunch of us were integrating this lunch counter. By the way, he was a fellow later governor of the state, Lester Maddox, had the pickaxe in front of him. I saw him at a distance. We didn't directly test his restaurant that day, but we went to one not too far from it. I still remember this lady shaking, white lady shaking, her slender arms and muscles, this boiling, scalding hot water, and she was going to pour it on us. She was going to dump it on us, and she was right with me. You know, black, white, black. Her whole, remember, I have some sense of the other side of the line. Her whole world was threatened. Everything. She was just so upset and so troubled, and I thought I was going to take a pretty good hit, right in the face. There's nothing in nonviolence that says I have to keep my head up. I always figure how fast could I get my head down, but it would have been, I mean, it's really a moment. And shortly thereafter, Dickie Romilly is here today. I was mentioning this to her. It's one of the things I remember that she does. And a lady named Casey Hayden called Bruce Gordon, Joe Iyer, and Bruce is black, Joe's white, and me, to say there's a lot going on down in Savannah. Hosea Williams is a SCLC affiliate, the Chatham County Crusade for Voters. Benjamin Clark, very charismatic guy. Maybe we could go down there and be of some help and do a SNCC SCLC thing, and we would go down. And so off we go, the three of us, we drive, you know, from Atlanta to Savannah. We get there and walk into this.
Who's the three again? You?
Rick Tuttle, that's my name, and Joe Iyer, who's a student at Haverford. It's either EYRE or I think that's it. And he's a notch younger than me. I was 23, Joe's probably 20. A very sharp guy. And Bruce Gordon, who I'm 99% sure is not the Bruce Gordon who became head of NAACP. That Bruce Gordon's born in 1946. The Bruce Gordon with whom I was not 17 or 18. He was a man of 21 or 22 and enormous leadership capacity, terrific guy. So I remember this all in the summer after Birmingham and before the March on Washington. Did you hear Reverend Lawson's speech today?
Unfortunately, I didn't.
He talked about the summer of 63 and how work needs to be done in that, and that there were 1,000 demonstrations that summer. Tom Hayden, in his at least his first biography, I'm not sure if Tom has a second memoir or not, has a footnote where he took the trouble to, which I recommend to anyone who's looking at the period, the time I read his book and looked at the footnote, the data rang true to me intuitively, or I'll use the double negative, it's not counterintuitive. He had the number of arrests and people who went to jail and this whole Gandhi, Dr. King, nonviolent pursuit of justice over that time, in that time period of that 63 summer. So in any event, you know, filled the jails, that kind of thing. So we're down there in Savannah. I never forget this. Walk into this church, it's a Catholic church. Well, I think it was a Catholic church. There were some Catholic churches involved. And it was made available, civil rights movement. And there was going to be a night march, and there's a big you know, tremendous speaking, and then they pass the baskets around. Big baskets. And there are sappers and knives and brass knuckles all getting tossed in. All stuff. You know, Savannah's, for one thing, a port town. So you have a lot of longshore and people like that. And these night marches meant working men and women could march. And so the huge line, so off we go in these marches. I'm there the first night. It's just incredibly good. I mean, a tremendous. I've heard good speeches in my life and have since. And these are individuals who are very at one with what they were saying and doing and targeting. And they were basically, in this case, it was not so much voter registration, it was public accommodations and desegregation. DeSoto Hotel, a major hotel in Savannah, and a variety of other such public locations. Mm-hmm. So these night marches were to go down, march around the hotel, or march around whatever the target was and march back.
And these are local folks who are talking?
And Hosea Williams later became the lieutenant of Dr. King, came out of Savannah. He had been lived there. He was a chemist, the U.S. federal government. He was on leave, but his salary was protected, so he was federal, not paid locally. His wife had run and lost the race for a commission or some elected position in Chatham County, which is Savannah. So the SCLC affiliate is the Chatham, C-H-A-T-H-A-M, the Chatham County Crusade for Voters, which was a Southern Christian Leadership affiliate. Mm-hmm. And SNCC had sent me down to be, along with the other two men I mentioned, young men to mention. And we were being put up a day or two later in some accommodations, and I come in, and there's upstairs, and I go up one floor, another floor, another floor, and there were all sorts of young ladies around, here and there, a fellow walking by, coming down the stairs, we're going up, and I didn't pay much attention for a few days, and then in chit-chatting with my two colleagues, realized, wait a minute, this is a house of prostitution. And if you think about it for a while, it gives some sense of the variety of the human soul. Because on the one hand, I mean, people make a living one way or another. In this case, I would not want to make a living running a house of prostitution. I don't think it would be a nice thing to do or something I wanted to do. And to me, it's something I view with some considerable distaste, frankly. On the other hand, think of the act of political consciousness to give us free lodging. Mm-hmm. They were helping in the movement. They were part of it. Also, they put their property up for bail.
Are these white folks or black folks? These are white folks.
Black. Yeah. Black. Funeral parlors, places like that.
Barbershops.
That kind of thing. But in any event, so this went on for a bit, and I was doing these marches. So there I am, as in a sore thumb. And there I am, Joe. There's Joe Iyer and me. And all kinds of cameras, click, 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 all sorts of law enforcement, press, others. Most of it, though, I think law enforcement. So they say, all right, Rick, we want you to go undercover. Well, it was about a damn fool thing as I've ever done, because now I'm going to these meetings of these white supremacist groups. I've been made all over Savannah with pictures and scattered through these meetings. They're perfectly, it's a free country, they're perfectly entitled to attend if they want on their own time as law enforcement. There are all sorts of police officers and deputy chiefs and others who are part of these groups there. The world is changing on them, and they don't like it, mm-hmm. and they're concerned about it. Things they've grown up with, and their parents have grown up with, and their great-grandparents have grown up with, and so on. And so I went to a number of these. They had me take lodgings in Savannah, and I went to a variety of meetings on the outskirts of Savannah and so on. I went to one meeting, which was Klan, not a small meeting. It was a large meeting in the evening and so on, but there were a fair number of weekend meetings where I went, and I'm just lucky I didn't get myself beaten up pretty badly. I don't think I would have been killed, but I think I could have been pretty badly roughed up. I was having my teeth knocked in or something. But after a while, there wasn't much information to get, so after a while, suggest I come on back in. So I did. So I came in back in, and meanwhile there were more demonstrations, and there was a night, the one night I wasn't in them, I wasn't feeling well, and I went to sleep in this house I talked about, upstairs. all hell broke loose that night in Savannah. Someone threw a brick. There was trouble in Savannah. Meanwhile, the leadership was being arrested and held on a form of preventive detention. Hosea Williams, Ben Clark, and others were being held on a form of preventive detention called good behavior bonds, sometimes called peace bonds, where people say, my peace is being, it's like disturbing the peace, except individual citizen charge says, this person's bothering me, bothering my peace. And they used to be used for domestic violence. They're post-Reconstruction statute, and a judge had discovered these and was using them to basically take into custody the leadership of the movement, which is one reason all hell broke loose. And they had about 50 people in custody, and they were holding them. And they picked me up on a John Doe warrant. They came into the office and took me into custody. So in I go. Now, there's an irony to it. I'm there on the phone. They come bursting through the door. I had just been in a conversation in town for a visit with Andy Young, who is Dr. King, number three or number four aide, and Reverend Bevel, who had organized Birmingham. They happened to be there. I'm talking with them. I've never seen two individuals get more interested in the floor as those two fellows as they eased away. They were here, standing about as far away as you were. They'd come in even right at me. The John Doe warrant was for me, but they had a bunch of other warrants. These two fellows just kind of moved away, and I realized in a flash my assignment was to keep them focused on me.
On you, right.
So I say, in my best, mounting my full civil liberties platform, but at the same time, I'm saying, I need to see a warrant. They said, here, a John Doe warrant. About this time, they're coming around behind me to put on the cuffs. And they had one black officer and the rest were white. And I said, I don't see my name anyway. I moved, but at the same time, I have enough sense to be walking out of there. They take me and miss the number three and four, number, I don't know, four and six. They could have badly crippled this other Christian Leadership Conference movement. So they wound up with me. So I wind up in the Chatham County Jail, and as I'm leaving.
Running out soon.
Okay, so we just take one break and we're just going to swap out tapes.
Sure.
Okay, just take a quick break.
Again. No. It was a terrible time to stop, but
it's fine. Okay, so picking up where we left off,
They walk me down, they take me into custody as I go out the door. UPI reporter's coming up the stairs, and he knows me. He'd been around. And I was glad to see the reporter, just for my own safety, it was good. And
That, why was that? Because that meant somebody knew that you...
Yeah. And I saw a look across his face. He was going to do something with this, and he did run a small story.
Mm-hmm.
My folks got to get the guy calls. Oh, your son is in jail. What? I mean, yeah. But that sort of thing. But the but in any event, so the usual procedures were going in, and so I'm in my cell. They put me in isolation. I'm in my cell, and I'm asleep. And there's this light in my eyes, and there's this voice, and he keeps saying, in a very measured, soft tone, "I'm not in the Klan. I'm not in the Klan." I'm waking up at this point. I'm not in the Klan. I had enough sense to sleep completely dressed and so on. So there was my shoes were off, but I had somewhat less vulnerability than otherwise. The light's right on me. I'm not in the Klan. By now he knows I'm awake, but my brother is. That's the guard. Right there. Hey, Bubba. No, he would say, hey, Bubba. I'm not in the Klan, Bubba. I'm not, hey, Bubba. Oh, I'm not in the Klan. and it happened. The Klan was marching in Savannah that night. They were having a march. Now, this is Savannah, not a small town in Mississippi, but nonetheless, it had my attention. And and it may have been why it was on this fellow's mind. So kept me in there. And rather than go day by day or week by week, I was in for about a month and a half. And along with, but there two, I'll simply mention two or three vignettes and, mm-hmm. and so on. But the one is that after a period of time, let's say a week or two, I was moved into the main cell block. Of the, it's a jail. This is not the state penitentiary. This is a jail. And there's a screen, and I was segregated. So I'm over on the white side of the cell block.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all sorts of showers. There's individual. And I'm in another white prisoner. They were downstairs and upstairs. Is the women are in custody. There's a lot of our civil rights demonstrators. Then I gathered there's a third floor where there's a TV, and where the so-called trustees, they're called bridge boys, are located. And these are people who you know bring cigarettes, coffee, candy bars, deliver newspapers, and so on. They may even go off site a little bit. And I remember one of them carried himself well and had a kind of roll of the shoulders and athletic. Popeye is his name. He's a quite well-known welterweight prize fighter in Savannah area, and which is a pretty good town for that sort of thing. Long shore, as I mentioned, so on and so forth. Well, anyway, I wondered contemporarily, no one's jumping me. I was prepared to get jumped. I figured it's probably gonna happen. It didn't. And I was working out a lot. I was doing push-ups and one arm. I was pretty good shape. I was doing one arm push-ups, not to intimidate, just to be in as good a shape as I could, and so on and so forth. I later learned, and as I told the story, unavailable emotion is to say, my God, how remarkable. They said, I later learned, Bruce Gordon told me this, that they said to the white prisoners as they brought them in, because the bridge boys were part of the, you know, strip them down, search them. Mm-hmm. They didn't do the internal exam, but that's done by other personnel, but they were, you know, bringing them along, so on. You touch this guy, we'll beat the hell out of you. Now think about that. They were willing to trade easy time, probably for the state pen. For me, not for me, but for the movement. Not just for me, but for the movement. That's a remarkable act, from my point of view, of decency and of consciousness.
So who was it that was saying, telling
these
you?
These were the trustees. These were fellows who were in jail, who were favored. In other words, these were they call rich boys, but they're the ones who deliver the cigarettes, the newspapers. They have the run of the prison, the jail. They have the run of the jail, upstairs, downstairs. They have all the little distribution of things that makes life reasonably agreeable in a place like that. We are in custody for a while. And from their point of view, it was easy time compared to, I mean, it's not as good as being on the outside.
Right.
They saying to these white guys who are often in for car theft, drunk, stealing things, breaking and entering, stuff. They were all thrown in there with me. Friday nights was a real time, coming in. They said, don't touch him or we'll beat the hell out of him. Which would then get them into trouble with the authorities.
Sure, they're black, the bridge boys.
All of them were.
Yeah,
and it was a remarkable act of consciousness, and I didn't know about it. Which, in some religious traditions, for example, in Judaism, the tradition of a mitzvot or a mitzvah is to do something, and for the person who's the recipient of the favor, not to be told.
Hmm. And you found out about it only years later.
I learned about it near the end of my stay, through Bruce Gordon, who was in custody himself, and he was on the other, and he picked it up on their side. They never told me. I just simply wasn't getting touched.
Right.
Which is the other story was that there are a couple of other stories. One of them is that after a while, you had this screen, and in the, this is Savannah, Georgia, we had among the guys, who were ladies upstairs of similar background, a lot of them were people who just got, a lot of them were 19-year-olds, 18 and a half, 20-year-olds, but basically 18 and a half-year-olds, just out of high school. We had the high school champion in the 880. We had the student body president of the Savannah Black High School. Upstairs, we had the secretary of the student body. That's who we had, Joe. We had that type of youngster there, plus a lot of other kids from other backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bruce Gordon got a very good idea. He said, let's have ourselves a freedom school. So remember, we had this great, so I taught civics, he taught chemistry, someone else taught algebra, and so on. And you could begin to, in other words, we're not people who did anything wrong. And you could see it begin to have an impact on the guards.
Hmm.
You could see it. And for that matter, on some of the prisoners, who the ones who were staying around, who weren't being released after a few days of being held.
So did you actually like create a class schedule?
Yeah,
and that
but you clusters. We had clusters.
Mm-hmm.
Through me, through the great. And others and others parts of the others were all African Americans, so they, and I was the white guy, but I was able to do the civics thing. So we, you know, heck, I mean, we were working our way up to the Spanish American War before we were all let out. I mean, darn it, we needed to get through the curriculum.
Right.
Right. So then there are other stories as well, but there was an episode where the Atlanta Constitution began to develop a storyline, and my dad could see it coming, I could see it coming, but I was getting the paper, or getting the Savannah paper, and we got to get the Atlanta paper, that the Chatham County Crusade for Voters office was in the mine mill smelters office, the union office, the mine mill smelters had been one of the several CIO unions that had been kicked out of the CIO because it had been communist nominated. In fact, the extras for the movie Salt of the Earth, which was a left film, were fellows who had been and women who had been in the mine mill smelter union.
Hmm.
And their office happened to be, I don't think anyone had any particular sense of their Marxist Leninism or anything else, but they were in that office and getting it for a dollar or a month or something or for nothing and so, but they were there and the storyline was developing. And Rick Tuttle from Mississippi, who's now come into SNCC, who's now, you know, the blue work shirt now, and you can see a storyline beginning to develop.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So two things happen. My dad gets in the line that, you know, who's paying me? Well, Dad was able to show that I had to basically live off the land. I mean, living for free and the food, you just go along. But there had been some support from the Presbyterians, from the University Religious Conference Center, the Episcopalians, the URC at UCLA had, and there had been other denominations that each kicked in. You know, out of ministers and out of their discretion, priests out of their discretionary funds. You know, someone, you have to have some discretion, $50 here, $50 there. In those days, $50 is a fair amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
$50, $50, $50, you're able to, that was, those were my dad worked that, got that in. But the other thing that happened, Stanley Mosk was then the Attorney General of California. And he, my college roommate, who almost went with me and didn't do it, father was his campaign chair. He's running for, he had just gotten reelected. A terrific person. He's later the justice on our state Supreme Court and so on. The courthouse is named the Stanley Moss Courthouse
mm-hmm.
in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. He was Attorney General. Right. And he wrote a letter, an open letter to the Solicitor General of Georgia, saying that Rick Tuttle, I know him very well through my dear friends, and so and so and so and so. I mean, probably kept their names up, but through dear mutual friends. He's a patriot, all this sort of thing, or a good guy, and not a communist, and not all this sort of stuff. And sent that letter in, that was splashed all over the Atlanta Constitution. The story went away. And then what happened is, in my case, a remarkable man named Aaron Buschbaum came forward when I went, all remember my father, New Haven, Connecticut, all this stuff. And a man named Isidore Wexler, no relation, called his friend Bill Wexler. I called a man, person he knew, an ADL, Anti-Defamation League, who contacted someone else, and got Dr. William Wexler to put up his house, and then got us lawyers through Aaron Bushbaum, who's then a young attorney in town, trying to build a business practice. It took a lot of guts to do this, because he's taken on the, you know, we're taking a hell of a beating in the Savannah papers on this. He took them, he was willing to take the case like that, and they went in and were able to win the argument for me, and therefore for everyone else, that one piece of property should suffice, even if it's partially encumbered as a mortgage or something, should suffice to, rather than six pieces of property, times 50 people. That's too much property. You can't get anyone out.
Right.
And got me out, and then got everyone else out. And I then came back out to California, graduate school, all the rest of it. The Savannah movement, by now fall, autumn had come. And the Savannah movement went on and worked out and became the, partly due to these demonstrations and partly due to some other things that happened independent of my experience involving Nelson Rockefeller. But they, a remarkable story, which is a side story I'm glad to share, but doesn't have to do with my experience directly. They were celebrated, Dr. King came into Savannah for this, as the first city to successfully integrate. And they had a complete, biracial committees, and Aaron Bushbaum played a huge role in that, and the mayor of Savannah and so on. And I came back out to the coast. We got very involved in the fair housing fight out here in California, and basically put together a group also that was a friends of SNCC group. We called ourselves the Student Coordinating Committee. I'm going to give you one research tip.
Well, what happened with the charges?
And they basically let us out, and the charges then went away. And they were holding us. We were being. This was a form of preventive detention.
Oh, it was still on that, right. So there was never any other charge.
Peace bonds, yeah. Well, they just, yeah, they, the judge, I was let out.
Right.
And the judge, his name, I'll come back to me in a minute, Victor Mullen was the judge who had come up with this idea. And the judge who let me out, whose name will come back to me, and I'll get it to you, you should have it for this record. Very decent guy, and Apollo, and said to me at the end, and he, one piece of avail money will suffice. And the movement was over, the summer had ended, the demonstrations were over.
Right.
And so he let me out and then let everyone else out. And his name, Myrick, Shelby Myrick, M-Y-R-I-C-K. Okay. When I got the call some years later, sometime in the 70s, and did an interview for the Telfair, T-E-L-F-A-I-R Museum down in Savannah, there is a tape I have there that's around, and I used to have a transcript somewhere, could probably get another one. The lady who interviewed me, just very lovely, turned out to be his daughter. She's the one who did the interview. I didn't know that till the end of the interview. And then, and so then, life went on. I should mention something else too. There are two things I should mention to you, one of which may be of scholarly interest. Our student coordinating group, and now we're rolling towards Mississippi of 1964 and so on, we created we were fighting a fair housing fight in California, and a fellow named Joe Maislich, terrific guy, later was a resistor, went to prison for some time, federal penitentiary, resisting Vietnam. He was free and clear. He gave up his student deferment. He was about to age out of the process, and he, as an act of foreign, act of conscience.
Right.
His parents owned a radio station that was something of a friendly competitor to the Pacifica station, KPFK, KPFA, and a strong station. And they had a whole series of interviews with people in Mississippi, some of whom, the hook was often Los Angeles or Bay or West Coast volunteers who were down there. So there's a whole bunch of these interviews, Oh Natural. They were turned over to the UCLA library, and they're not cataloged. I'm working to try to get them discovered, but they would be these are contemporary tapes from the field in the summer of 64, and as far as I know, no one's worked with these. This is fresh stuff. So I hereby, I've been around the field enough to know that can be valuable. And I'm going to do what I'm doing what I can just on my own, try to get folks to find them, get them cataloged. It's all pre-digital, you know. But they have to be around somewhere. I can't believe they were.
So were they these phone call interviews?
Or, yes, they were.
From,
yes, they were.
From California.
Too. Yeah, but for but Mayslitz was a knowledgeable guy to interview.
Fascinating.
The other thing you should know, this is of less scholarly importance, but it may inform you some in terms of your work overall. Jonathan Estrin, E-S-T-R-I-N, he and his late wife wrote Cagney and Lacey, the TV series. He's an accomplished guy. He's now the head of the Constitutional Rights Foundation and a protean fellow. He does all sorts of things. He and acquaintance of his, a professional friend of his, wrote a script for a you know, the old, this before your time, but in my era, the radio shows, Jack Benny, Armis Brooks, great radio comedy, great radio shows. Well, using radio shows and readers, and it's very effective, they have done a reading series on Robert F. Kennedy and the Civil Rights Movement. And they've had a series of panels after these readings. I was on one of them. There were others. Some of them were scholars. Some of them were people there contemporarily who knew something about. I was at Robert Kennedy's campaign in 68. I had been upset with Mr. Kennedy for his slowness on civil rights, and you know, people standing around, FBI agents standing around taking notes while civil rights workers getting beaten up, freedom rides, all the rest. But President Kennedy, the President of the United States, made a shift just at the time of the integration of the University of Alabama, which is contemporary almost to the day with the assassination of Medgar Evers. And I'm winding up standing in the white supremacist rallies in Georgia. And the main theme is of these rallies is the excoriation of Robert F. Kennedy, the Attorney General, giving me a somewhat different view of Mr. Kennedy. And things had changed over that, say, 25-day period. There had been a shift where instead of the President of the United States and the Attorney General simply enforcing federal court orders, Eisenhower and the early Kennedy, President Eisenhower and early President Kennedy, we're now the President of the United States saying, imagine yourself being black. How would you like, which puts it on a moral basis. That shift cut all out venom directed at Mr. Kennedy, Attorney General Kennedy. They didn't take on the president, taking on Mr. Kennedy, Attorney General Kennedy. So I wind up in Robert F. Kennedy's campaign and have some of the civil rights background. So there's a, where I'm going with this is these are interesting shows, and NPR is going to put them on. National Public Radio has them. So they're going to, they'll edit. I may or may not be in it, but the point is there could be some interesting stuff in there. And you may want, that may give you also some leads if you're interested for your own Southern.
But you, so you ended up working for his campaign.
Hard. I met Muff died 5 years ago, but I met Muff in that campaign. Yeah, we were very involved. You know, of the, we had one thing that can't be dismissed, and that is that it's before your time and before your parents' time. And that is that we took 5 assassinations in less than 5 years. On our side of the aisle, we took Mr. Evers, Medgar Evers, we took President Kennedy, we took Malcolm X, who's going through an interesting evolution, we took Dr. King, and we took Senator Robert F. Kennedy. It's 5 assassinations. It was my privilege a few days, my sister lives in D.C., and a few days after Senator Edward Kennedy died, I made a point. I was in town anyway, I came in with Rebecca and see my sister, her brother lives up in Baltimore, that sort of thing. My 2 brothers live in the suburbs, and we made a point first thing to go to Arlington to visit Senator Edward Kennedy's gravesite. And as I stood there, I looked at a person who had lived his 70. He had lived, in fact, beyond 70, and a substantial body of work. A substantial body of work. a very human man, not a man without his weaknesses, a substantial body of work. Last time I looked, we all have our weaknesses. And the power of the thought of, my God, can you imagine, the, for the benefit of the nation and the world and the community, and in general my values, in general most of our values are the people who are here, but also just for the country generally, if we had had the benefit of the body mm-hmm. of work of Dr. King, of Medgar Evers, of Malcolm X with his evolutions, with President Kennedy, with Senator Kennedy, they hadn't all been cut down. I think probably the average would be about 41 years of age, 42 years of age, if you just average it. And instead of getting their 80 years or their 75 years, it's mm-hmm. very powerful. And I realized, I went over to Medgar Evers' grave, he was buried at Arlington, and of course was at Robert F. Kennedy's grave, and I was a very close friend of Albert Lowenstein. Bill Chafe interviewed me at length for the Lowenstein
book, right,
great
right.
length.
Right.
And given my regards. Setting Al aside, though, with all due respect, Al was killed some years later in 1980, but in that five years, two of the five I spoke with within a couple hours aside before they were murdered. It's kind of a powerful, the first and the fifth.
Right.
It brings it home. Anyway, that's those. I can go on and on,
incredible.
But it gives you some vignettes, and I hope this is some help to future students of history.
It is. But by way of closing, maybe we could you could talk for a moment about going back to these sites in Mississippi and Georgia, which I understand you've done fairly recently.
Yes, after I think I mentioned this to you off camera, but I'm glad to talk about it on camera. My first wife passed away after a wonderful marriage, and Rebecca lost her husband. We all knew each other. We were well acquainted. We were a family of Temple Akiba, Culver City, and it's out in the Los Angeles area. I pursued her for a couple of years, a few twists and turns, and finally got the lady to agree to marry me. And as I think I mentioned earlier, we married at the UCLA, at the faculty club, and then went on to. And she had come up with the idea of the honeymoon, you know, it was going to be Hawaii, it was going to be this or that, the other thing. And she said, let's fly into Birmingham and we'll take a trip around the South. And then I realized the day after the wedding, we had a day in between, got focused on it, but what she had in mind, and we did it, was we went to Winona, Mississippi, where Mrs. Hamer was. We went at Rebecca's suggestion. And then on to Greenwood, and we went to where 708 Avenue N used to be located, which is where the COFO office was. It's now, then on to Canton, Mississippi.
It doesn't exist anymore?
No, the slab is there, though, and a lot of the discussions took place out on the slab, you know, out just on the outside. A lot, you know, 1 foot up on the slab and talking,
right.
Someone smoking, maybe a couple of people smoking. There wasn't the sensitivity about smoking we have now, but still people would step outside for a smoke. There's plenty of smoking inside too. A lot of people smoke. I didn't, but people were nervous, they're concerned, or just enjoyed smoking. And so a lot of conversations there, butting out the cigarette, talking, and so on and so forth. And that slab is there. Mm. And then in a great project, I talked to Charlie Cobb. His book is terrific, if you've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it has exact addresses to confirm in writing what I remembered,
right.
708.
Right.
And it had some reassurance. We need to get the National Park Service in this Congress and this presidency to put together the funds for a plaques for these various offices. It doesn't have to be just SNCC-centric, but there are offices around the country, usually, by the way, in low-income neighborhoods. That's where they should be, a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
such as the poorest part of Greenwood. I think there were two very, very powerful stories that came out of that trip. So we go to Greenwood, and it's a November day, it's a kind of leaden sky, we're there in the poorest part of Greenwood, and in one of the poorer parts of the Delta. And I'm there, and I'm looking around, and I find myself feeling a feeling that I deeply regret, and a feeling that a feeling that was palpable, and that is, I was disappointed in my country.
Hmm.
And it also, in a different way, because I had yet to go to Arlington. But a different way reminded me of what we had lost when we had lost Robert F. Kennedy and Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King and so on and so forth, in terms of people who, before their time, who would have helped keep the attention of the country focused on these issues of poverty. Mm-hmm. In this case, race and poverty, but the same could be said about Appalachia or other neighborhoods too, where this area, even more than it was, is been left behind. So that was, but the poignant part was, we looked around and I started, there was no one around. It was a little like a movie called The Last Picture Show.
Mm-hmm.
Everything but a shutter banging against. And there were a couple of fellows working on something. They were very nice. I was appropriately reticent about anything about my background, but Rebecca had a way of bringing mm-hmm. it up, and they figured out this guy, they call it Freedom Fighters or Freedom Riders, and they were tremendously helpful. And I said, well, is there anyone, I'm looking for someone around my age. Is there anyone around who might have been around then? You know, share a moment or two. They said, well, there's a little store, it's next block over. We go over, and it's one of these places that's completely double boarded up with a door that has double door security doors. So it's all very difficult, not possible, I'm sure, but very difficult to break into. It's a general store right there for that part of Greenwood, Mississippi, in the heart of the most poverty, one of the most poverty stricken places in the country. And outside, we drive over, we get out of the car. My wife is, I'm 70 now, I was 68 and 11 12ths at the time. And Rebecca, a trim lady in her late 50s, but we come hopping out of, they gave us an upgrade when we came into Birmingham, so we had a pretty good looking car, a black car. I come hopping out of the car, she hops out. I'm made for a veteran police officer,
right.
A flash, and or God knows what, and she's made, you know, in the modern world, a trim looking veteran police woman. So we come piling out of the car, there's five or six fellas standing there, and on the corner where the general store is. The general is obvious where the general store is. It's a rather faded, painted sign that says something like general store.
Right.
So I go out, or actually beer things. So we go up and they stand there, they're backing off, and I'll put it this way, giving us a very measured look.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the fairest way to put it. And we acknowledge them, and we walk in, and there's three or four ladies in there, and older and so on and so forth, and one of them, in fact, is back in the day. She was a little younger, but she was around. She was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had had some of this experience coming before we got to Greenwood. We had made a stop on the way up at a very backwoods area off the main highway. Then we had stopped in Winona, and it had incredible reception there, which I guess I should also mention because it's important. And then we came over to this Greenwood situation. And meanwhile, a couple of different times, one of the fellows would come in, and as apparently was a custom, he would buy one cigarette
mm-hmm.
and pay, I forget if it's 50 cents, I think it's 50 cents, or buy two for a dollar. It's that kind of transaction. But what they were really doing is checking out who the heck is this fellow and who's this lady. Well, and they do a couple of dipsticks in to see what's going on. And by this point, we're singing freedom songs. I mean, we're singing arcane lyrics of the good old days. I mean, we're into it. She's into it, I'm into it, and the others have picked it up. They're younger, but not that much younger. They picked it up derivatively. We're into the appropriate songs, and we're not shouting them out, but we're having a good time, and we're way back in there,
right?
In terms of the memories, and by now these emissaries coming and going, or not emissaries, these checkers coming and going. One of the more moving moments in my life, they had figured out, this guy's a freedom fighter. And when I came out of that store, the look of affection was palpable. Never seen anything like powerful stuff. So that's one. And then another time I wound up over in Savannah, and we go in there and we're in the and the jail, the Chatham County Jail, which gave me the benefit of its hospitality for a month and a half. It turned out the Savannah College of Art and Design, SCAD, is proprietary. Have you been to Savannah? Do you know SCAD?
I've actually never been there.
Someone figured out there was a lot of property that could be at different times and different recessions or different, maybe just structurally in Savannah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of property lying around you can buy up for very little. Mm-hmm. And some entrepreneurial people with a sense of how to make a living, an honest living, set up this college, the Savannah College of Art and Design. And there is enough of aesthetic. You know, Sherman did save Savannah. Mm-hmm. Sherman did not destroy Savannah. So you have a history that goes back. And there's an arts, and so they've taken the jail. I'll just conclude with this. They've taken the jail, and they've created the cells are basically artists' work areas. The second upstairs are the lofts and downstairs. So I'm able to go in and show my wife. It's a Sunday, but the security guard, when they figured out what was going on, let us in, to look in and see the cell. I mean, there it was. I mean, it's where I was. That itself was a very powerful feeling. There's another story that took place in Winona, but I think it's best not to discuss that on tape. I'll for a variety of reasons.
Okay. Okay, so we'll leave that, David, there. Well, thank you very much.
Well,
I'm really
honored to have this opportunity, and as I said earlier, I hope it's helpful to future students and scholars.
I'm sure it will be.
Good luck to
you
and your work.
Thank you very much.
Let me give you my card also for both you gentlemen, if you find yourself coming up.